This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy to welcome here into the studio my very, 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 very favorite lawyer, and I say that very happily, because I've, as some people know, I've had some experiences with lawyers, and that's why I found the very, very best. And we have our own legal eagle here, right here on Joy on Paper, to answer your legal questions about your intellectual property, because it is so valuable, and you want to protect it. And as I have been getting emails from people, I want you to know that Bill Larson has the right answer, and he can lead you in the right direction. I'm so happy that you're here in the studio with me, Bill.
Good morning.
Okay, great. Well, over the past few months, I've really gotten more involved with people who are getting themselves into some legal troubles. And it's funny, and it happens. And, you know, I want all of you listeners to understand that it happens to everyone. Clive Cussler has had so many lawsuits. Even Mary Higgins Clark, and you think Mary Higgins Clark, nobody could ever think that she'd done anything bad in her life. But boy, oh boy, somebody comes out of the woodworks and says, oh, you must have read my thing, and then you wrote this whole book and made a fortune because you stole it from me. So you have to protect your intellectual property, and you need a lawyer. Believe me, I didn't. When I was young, I made a mistake. You don't want to do the same. Right, Bill?
That's right. Now you're all lawyered up.
I'm lawyered up, and I love it because it makes you feel really safe. And, you know, that's what you need. You don't need to have these. One woman, actually, who recently got herself involved in a situation in which she was giving money to somebody for, let's say they were going to do something with her book, and she had a lot of sleepless nights because she didn't know how she was going to tell her husband. And you don't want that to happen to you.
Definitely not.
Okay, so, Bill, we've got some really good questions from some listeners. And one of them I found very interesting and reminded me of a story. This is a writer wrote in. She said, recently I've sold ebooks in India, Amazon India, and UK. Is there any legal information that indie authors should be aware of when they sell books outside the U.S.? I just assumed I have all the rights to my books, which includes international, but now I'm wondering if I should take other steps. I have my books registered with the U.S. Copyright Office.
Great question. So how do we protect our copyrights overseas? And the way we do that is through the use of the local courts in the country where an infringement might occur. In this case, India or the UK. Now, the nice thing about India and UK is they speak English there. And if you have to enforce a copyright in a country that doesn't speak English, then you have to translate it, so that raises your costs. And whenever we are perfecting our rights overseas, patents, trademarks, or copyrights, we usually are going to hire an associate from that country to help us through the system, because each country is just a little bit different. Now, the nice thing about copyrights is that when you register them in the United States, they are protectable in all of the countries in the world that are a member of what's called the Berne Convention, okay? And the Berne Convention is just an international treaty for the protection of copyrights. So if the country's a member of the convention, then a registration in any one of those countries of copyright is enforceable in any other country without any further registration process. All right? But now there still could be some local customs or local rules or stuff that you wouldn't want to know about. And so when I have international cases, I'll usually lean on some of my associates, of which I have in every single country of the world, and ask them, is there anything particular that we need to do? And so in this case, yes, your copyrights, if they're registered here in the United States, are protectable in India. But we'd have to take one step more, get a hold of one of our associates in India, and ask if there's any other things we can do to, you know, bolster and help our copyrights in the event that there is an infringement.
And many people don't realize that one of the a really great market for books in English is India.
There huge are, market. Huge market.
Huge. 100 million people in India read primarily English. They speak a lot of languages, but they all go to university and learn English. They all learn, actually, they learn English as grade school students. And they prefer to read in English.
That's correct.
And that is why Robin Cook is one of the best-selling authors in India. He has sold hundreds of millions. He's approaching almost a billion books that he's sold. But much of the number of the books that he sold have been in India because they love his books. All of Robin Cook's books are medical mysteries.
Yeah.
And they love medicine, and they love that type of storyline.
There's a high literacy rate. They're very educated people. Oh, they're very consumer oriented.
Oh, very. So if you can hit
big market.
A big market. So if you can write a book that appeals to people in India who are exactly what Bill just said, they're very well educated. They like medical stories. They like stories that really challenge their minds. And they are, that's a market. And they're readers. They are readers.
Yes.
They love to read.
They also have a highly developed film industry. So they've been adapting novels to film.
Exactly.
And, they really have some
I think this writer's...
So India is an excellent place to try to sell your books and stuff. If you're going to sell in India, then I would say let's get a hold of one of the folks in India who specializes in copyright law and publication, and just make sure that everything we're doing is okay. Because Amazon is an area where you can get infringement. Okay, somebody's going to go and copy your book, they're going to pop it on Amazon, and they're going to try to sell infringing copies. And if that were to happen, then we would want to have a local attorney in whatever country we're working in to help us shut that down quickly. Now, with Amazon, they have their own intellectual property kind of arbitration process that they use. So there's things you can do with Amazon by signing up with them to make sure that when an infringement occurs, you can quickly move within the Amazon dispute resolution arbitration process rather than the court system to eliminate infringing copies.
Okay. Well, I think that answers that question. And as I said, it's very important that you really talk to a lawyer, particularly if you feel that you're going to be able to sell, your books are going to be very appealing in India. Wow. I would make sure that I was protected.
And if you're going to get an attorney overseas, get a U.S. attorney to be your liaison. Don't try to do it yourself.
Oh, no.
Because you really need to have a U.S. counsel who manages your foreign counsel is the best way to do it.
Exactly. Well, and the next question. Let's go to the next question. And is there any recourse? Oh, this is a fun one. Is there any recourse once you've paid a company, obviously a publishing company, to print your book, and you don't think that they've done a good job? And this person says that there were some half pages, and paragraphs were broken in the middle, and even a blank page between chapters. And I must have been reading that book. I recently got a book that was published by a small publisher. I mean, it's terrible. I can't stand it.
Poor quality.
Yeah, very.
All right, so it's a defective product, okay? And in this case, it's no different than any other product. And whenever we're dealing with products, we're dealing with what's called the Uniform Commercial Code, which is a standard set of laws concerning the purchase and sale of goods and what you do if you have a defective product or a dispute of some kind, okay? So the Uniform Commercial Code is the one that defines how you're going to get a remedy and whether it's a defective, okay? It's not merchantable. If what is we're hearing here is true and the book has all of these errors and clearly it's not a quality product and we would want to claim it's defective and make a protest with the publishing company. And so that would depend on what is also involved in any written contract exists. So if our listener has a written contract, we'd have to consider that first because there may be a limitation on remedies or other terms in the contract that are important to decide how we would resolve this. And oftentimes, you know, first you have to make a protest. You may have to go through another number of steps or jump through some hoops. But if the product is unacceptable, you want to take action right away because sitting on your hands and waiting can be considered a waiver. So you may want to make an immediate protest. In a case like this, you certainly want to get a lawyer involved. In this case, doesn't necessarily have to be an intellectual property attorney, just a contract lawyer, because this is just a simple state contract claim, would not be an intellectual property claim. And then you can find out what your rights are and your remedies and take it from there.
And the first step, a lawyer would generally write a letter to the...
First thing a lawyer will do is see if there's a written contract. Okay, if there's no written contract, okay, now we have an oral contract, and now we're completely defined by the Uniform Commercial Code. If there's a written contract, then we have to see what the contract says. There may be a limitation of remedies. And so, in other words, what you can do about it and how long you have to take to make a protest. So the first thing the lawyer would do is take a look at that contract, okay, and then take a look at the product to see if it's defective.
Now, in generally speaking, when it depends on the different publishing companies, but this is not so much a published company, it's a printing company. Because they're not...
So something went wrong with the run. You know, this can happen with clothing. This can happen with any product, okay? And if there's not enough quality control coming from the manufacturer, then these defective copies can slip through. And, of course, then it's the receiving party, the author, that's picking through them and finding these errors. And so the author has to make a protest and possibly reject them, send them back, and say, nope, start over and do it again.
Okay. Well, you know, there are so many things that an author has to be aware of in this day and age. You have to take this responsibility on your own. And again, signing contracts is when you buy a car, you sign contracts. When you do this, you sign contracts. And so often writers think, and as you mentioned, that there are still people who think that they can just send their book to themselves by registered mail and it's protected. And it's not. And if your property is valuable to you and you want to protect it, really get a lawyer. And if you're going to sign contracts, just to have a sort of a lawyer in your back pocket. I know I can tell you, for the little bit of money, I would have had to pay a lawyer to look at the contract I signed once.
You wouldn't have signed it.
Not only wouldn't I have signed it, I would be rich today. So please, please, I'm telling you people, do not sign contracts. You know, without...
So when I have a client that comes to me with a contract, obviously I make sure that I put in a number of terms that are remedies. Okay, what happens if this, if that?
Yeah, don't want a remedy in some place where...
There's a handful of things that can go wrong that are very typical in these kind of contracts, and I know what they are. So I make sure that I put stuff into the contract to protect my client.
Yeah, and even the largest publishers, they're not... You have to remember, even I'm talking the big, big publishers, they are... their lawyers are protecting the publishing company. They're not there to protect you.
No.
You know, it's hard. You think, well, would they actually put anything that's not so nice in a contract? Yes, they would. I'm telling you, they would. So
that's the nature of our system.
That's right. And you don't want to go away signing away your rights, signing away your international rights, for example, which I know people who have done that. They've signed. They did not realize they were signing everything.
Give away your rights.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen contracts where it says that even if we do everything wrong, it's not our fault. Too bad, and you have no remedy.
Too bad.
People
so
don't see
sad.
That and they sign that. Yeah. You are allowed to waive your rights in this country. Okay. So you have a set of rights, but you can waive them. You can sign on if you sign on the bottom of the page, bottom of the contract, and you agree to waive your rights. They're gone.
They're gone. And then they just say, too bad, so sad. That's the way it goes. You know, that's the way the cookie crumbles. So it's...
So stand up for yourself, get a lawyer, have a lawyer look at your contract, make sure it's okay before you sign it. And then also, if that lawyer has looked at that contract beforehand, then you have a problem later, the lawyer's ready to jump into action and take care of it because they were part of the process.
Exactly. That's why I say to have a lawyer in your back pocket is really a comforting feeling because... As this recent encounter with an author and her worries about having to tell her husband that she got herself into a mess was very, very stressful for her. And a writer has enough stress without having to worry
to deal
about
with
stuff.
Legal issues.
So, really, that's all I can tell people. Please, please listen. Now, we have another question here. And this is somebody who's written a book. And at the beginning of each chapter, and she's, as a matter of fact, I've had a chance to look at them. At the beginning of each chapter, she has a poem. Now, one of the things that, generally speaking, you know, books of poetry are, you probably can't find an agent for, but sometimes writers really have wonderful poems and they put them in a book. But in this case, she put a poem at the beginning of each chapter. And they are delightful poems. And so everybody said to her, the people who read the book actually, she hasn't, they said, well, you should just take the poems and make a book with illustrations, because it's rather like a sort of Agatha Christie nursery rhyme book.
Yes.
So she put a nursery rhyme kind of poem at the beginning of each book, each chapter. And now everyone wants to take those poems and turn them into a little book, an illustrated children's book.
Right.
So now does she have to, before she hasn't shown it to an illustrator, so does she have to take the poems out and make it into a new book as a copyright first?
So the question here is this one work or is it many works? And that defines how we're going to apply for and receive copyright registration. So if the poems are separate and distinct from the other part of the text in the book, then it could be a separate copyright. All right, so we need more information to know for sure. But you can't go wrong by breaking stuff out and filing it under separate copyright applications and getting separate registrations. And the downside is you have to pay more file fees. But if you separately copyright certain smaller parts, then if those individual pieces are infringed, you have a better lawsuit protecting yourself. Okay? So if you bundle everything up in a great big book and just register that one thing, and somebody just takes a little snippet out of it, the court may say, well, they took such a small part of the entire work that it's really not an infringement. So if you break your copyrights up, for illustrations on the one hand, and your poems on the other, and some text on the other, then if somebody steals any individual component, you have a separate registration to use to enforce, okay? And that's the strategy I like to use. So I'm not sure in this case whether or not our author has registered the copyright, so we'd need to find that out first.
The book she's registered.
She registered as a copyright.
As a full book.
All right. So there's no such thing as re-registering a copyright, but you can register them in different ways, okay? So if you remove part of that and put, let's say we carve out the poems and put those into a separate book, we could theoretically file a separate copyright application for those particular poems as they're arranged in that book.
Okay.
All right. So that's one way to do it. So you need to see a copyright attorney. Okay, you need to have a strategy on how you're going to register stuff. I noticed here also that before I give it to someone to illustrate in the question, well, before you go and talk to somebody about illustrations, go see a copyright lawyer, because you need a contract between yourself and the illustrator to make sure that the illustrations,
yes,
the copyright and the illustrations are assigned to the author. Okay, so there's a little contract that we need in there. So that's important. So this is a complex question. It needs a complex answer. It needs more information to answer it fully. Go see a copyright attorney.
Yes, and I always like these questions about an illustrator, because I did write a children's book, a delightful children's book. And I was working with a friend who was an illustrator. Well, it was her first project, and we were friends. And I wanted, I thought we had a deal. We had a deal. She came back after, when she realized. And actually, it was funny. It turned out that my husband got a big contract, and she heard that we were suddenly rich. Well, we weren't actually. It was his company got the contract. He wasn't rich. But so she came back, and she changed. She tried to change the whole contract that it was from. That I was paying her $300, I was supposed to pay her $3,000.
Right.
Well, of course, I didn't have $3,000, and I didn't have.
Got to keep in mind that the copyrights can only be transferred in a written document.
Yeah.
Okay. So if I say, you and I have a handshake deal for the sale of a copyright, it's not enforceable in the courtroom. Okay.
Yeah.
It has to be in writing. Okay. And if it's not in writing, then the illustrator maintains the ownership of the copyright. All right. So the mere fact that you pay somebody money to draw for you or do something for you, absent a written contract assigning the copyright stays behind.
Okay. I hope all of you heard that, because I know there are so many of you who are out there planning your children's book. And I love children's books and I love picture books, but you have to make sure you just can't have a friend. Because friendship, sometimes money gets in the way, and that's why you need a lawyer.
Right? Right.
And that's why we have our wonderful Legal Eagle here in the studio. And we were talking about glorious Clearwater, Florida. It is always glorious here, even when we're going to have some terrible weather right now, I think.
We're going to get some rain today.
We're going to be heading out into that rain. But I do want to thank you so much, Bill, for coming in today.
Great questions.
And, you know, everybody... really, we have a few minutes. Just tell people a little bit about you, where you went to school, and about your company.
So we're here in Clearwater, Florida, Largo, which is just south of Clearwater. My firm's been in business 31 years now. All we do is intellectual property. My dad was a patent attorney for DuPont and retired in 1985, and that's when we started the firm. It was just my father and myself in the beginning. Now there's 10 of us total. And we practice patents, trademarks, and copyrights. We're U.S., most of our business is U.S., but we practice international also. So I found the question today about the international aspect of the copyright interesting. But we do prosecute intellectual property for our clients all over the world, and we represent people from other countries to prosecute intellectual property in the United States. And so I went to USF here, local here, a bull, and I went to law school at Golden Gate University in San Francisco. Great town, great state.
Exactly.
Got a great education there, and I have since then been doing nothing but patents, trademarks, and copyrights.
And you are a member of AIPLA.
AIPLA, which is the number one association for intellectual property attorneys. If you're looking for an attorney, go to AIPLA.org, and you'll find a good IP attorney in your town.
Exactly. And so, but right here in our area, you can find Bill. How can they find you?
Go to LarsonPatentLaw.com. That's my website. That's the best way to get a hold of me.
Okay, Bill. I want to thank you so very much for coming in today. It's been
my
wonderful.
Pleasure.
And just keep those questions coming in, because we want you to stay out of trouble, don't we?
Yes, we do. Keep the questions coming.
That's right. We just want to make sure that if you take the sort of all of that worry off of you, and you can concentrate on your writing, which is what you want to do. And so, again, I thank you for being in the studio today, Bill. And we're going to take a commercial break, and just about now, okay? We'll go ahead.
Okay? All righty.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bill. Great.
Inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com. Love a good book? Then the Book Swap of Carolwood is the place for you. They carry both new and used books. Looking for a cozy mystery, books for the kids, or a great thriller? They've got it all. So head over to the Book Swap of Carolwood, located at 11738 North Dale Mabry in Tampa. Valentine's Day is coming soon. Stop in and meet the friendly staff who will help you find the perfect gift. Remember, 11738 North Dale Mabry in Tampa. Book Swap of Carolwood has been part of the North Tampa community since 1984.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, the inventor of MyPillow, and like all of you out there, I had problems sleeping. Pillows would go flat, I would flip-flop all night long, I would wake up with a sore neck, maybe a headache, or feel like I needed a nap even though I slept 8 hours. When I invented MyPillow, I wanted it to where you can move the patented fill to give you the exact support you need as an individual, regardless of sleep position. MyPillow will get you into that deep sleep faster, and you will stay there longer. It's not about how much time we spend in bed, it's about how much of that quality sleep we get. I do all of my own manufacturing right here in the United States. I have a 10-year warranty. You can wash and dry my pillow, and I give you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you have nothing to lose. And here's my best offer ever.
My Pillow is now offering 50% off their 4-pack special.
Support Joy on Paper and local authors. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code PATSY, P-A-T-Z-I. Or call 1-800-871-1543. That's 800-871-1543.
From the Sunshine State, this is Tampa Bay's TAN Talk.
And we're going to be talking about her book, Rudy's Rules for Travel. And Rudy certainly had a lot of rules. Hi, Mary, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, great.
This is me.
Okay. Well, I'm so happy to have you on the program today because I found your book fascinating. And it is called Rudy's Rules for Travel. So you have to tell us about this Rudy character because he was quite a character. And it reminded me... It reminded me of Leroy Jethro Gibbs, who has numbers for everything, rules, and so your Rudy also had rules.
Rudy had a lot of rules. Probably a really good sequel will be Rudy's Rules for Everyday Living, because I know a lot of those, too. But in this book, I concentrated on the rules for travel, because they had a lot of those, too. Ours was a marriage of opposites. You probably saw that clearly from the first page in the book. But we nonetheless went traveling together in the 20th century, long before there were a lot of easy ways to travel, like no trip guides or trip advisors. And Rudy was his own trip advisor, definitely.
And no GPS.
No GPS. And no cell phone. And so, if you were lost, you were lost. There was no degree of being lost. You were totally lost.
And what people don't understand, I think, is how much fun it is to be lost sometimes. Some of your best adventures when traveling are those times that you are lost, because it's one, it shows the type of person you are, and also you get all sorts of, interesting experiences that you wouldn't have had if you just had GPS and went straight where you were supposed to be going.
Exactly. I think our lives have gotten more predictable and boring than they were in those days, where we didn't know what was really around the next corner. And
so tell us.
I think of being lost. Go ahead.
Tell us about Rudy. You got married. Tell us about how you met him and what your first, your first adventure was with him.
Yes, I came to Chico after having looked for a school psychologist job in Southern, I thought I was looking in Southern California, so I thought I was looking for, I was applying in a town named Chino, and it turned out to be that I had sent my resume to Chico, California, which I had never heard of, north of Sacramento. Rudy was a school principal in the Chico School District, and shortly after we met, he was telling his friends that we were a perfect match because he needed a psychologist and I needed an administrator in my life. So in that sense, we were in that.
So when he came out, when he first told you that he had the idea of having some rules, what did you think about that?
By that time, it was already pretty clear to me that he lived by like an internal set of rules, and they were pretty consistent. You had to save every penny because you needed to go someplace next summer, and it wasn't to save. I don't know when I met him if he had a bank account, but he had a travel account, and it was so that he could get back on the road. You know, he was born in Europe, and he had kind of a homing pigeon sense, first of all, of Europe, and then more broadly of the world.
And, of course, he had been in World War II.
That's right, and under really unusual circumstances. His father was a Hitler loyalist living in Washington, D.C., and Rudy was a young man, you know, at wartime, terribly distraught because he couldn't go fight for the American Air Force because he was an enemy alien. He had no citizenship and had applied for it in a timely way and had heard nothing. And so, you know, on a pretty much of a weekly basis, he used to go and knock on the doors of the recruitment offices and then try to explain to them that he saw a difference between the people and their government, and that for him, it made sense that he would fight their government because he would also save his homeland. And, you know, when people kind of wrapped their heads around that, he was finally accepted into the U.S. Air Force, and he was naturalized in a ceremony just before he was sent to to bombing missions over Europe. And at that point, his Air Force officers were standing behind him during that naturalization ceremony, you know, with that complete welcome.
Well, it's funny. One thing I know about pilots, people always assume that pilots are really good at directions. But I found that pilots, because my husband is a pilot, are great at directions when they're in the air. But sometimes they do get lost when they are on the ground.
Well, you know, actually, Rudy wasn't allowed to be a pilot. He started pilot training, but he wasn't allowed to be a pilot once it was realized, you know, that his birthplace was Germany. Because the pilot would be in charge of the plane and could take it place, probably. So that was their kind of bottom line fear. So he was a gunner on his crew and didn't finish any kind of pilot training until he came back home from the war. And then he fulfilled that kind of lifelong ambition to do at least private planes.
Now, when you met him...
But no, he was not good on the ground with directions, to answer your question.
I know. Oh, I know. My husband has gotten us lost so many places, but it's always been fun.
Yes, in the end.
In the end.
It's the process that can be challenging.
Okay, so tell us about your first trip with Rudy.
Yeah, the first trip was Mexico City, and I was living in an apartment at the time, and he came to my door, and he had this little tiny case. And it was a child's case. It was like you would put your doll clothes in, you know? It was a little case. And he told me that that was to be my suitcase because he had noticed that I was carrying a really large suitcase, and, you know, like normal people do. And that this was going to substitute. It was going to let us be free as we traveled. Well, that turns out to be true, you know, because he could stuff it in the trunk of a colectivo in Mexico City at the airport, and then throw me in the back seat with three other passengers already assembled there. He was really into it will be a lot cheaper if we split this eight ways. that was the beginning, and then I got a taste of his daring, his bravery in using foreign languages when he really didn't know what he was talking about. And we have I write of a scene in the dining room of beautiful Sheraton Hotel that we got into because of the devaluation of the peso the same day that we got there. And he took risks in travel and was not ever afraid to be embarrassed. He didn't see anything embarrassing about his behavior. And that was different than I was. You know, I was always looking at myself and trying not to look too foolish and not to look like a dumb American. And he pushed me out on the edge in that way, in a good way.
Now, you did so many travels, and I was trying to think of the one of the ones that I found amusing was the trip to Russia. Tell us about
dear.
That.
Well, it begins, of course, at home. We live in a little tiny mountain community in California, and Rudy's once a week gets the San Francisco Chronicle because it has all of the travel news and the travel, better yet, the travel ads, right? So he's got the San Francisco Chronicle on a Sunday morning about maybe 3 weeks before this trip leaves, and he sees an ad that advertises group travel to Russia. And this was after the Russians had been found to have bombed the Korean passenger jet airliner, and a State Department embargo had been on travel against Russia. So he's reading this in the newspaper, and he decides that that's where we'll spend Christmas. We can get ready pretty fast, no problem, and we can be on the plane to Moscow, and because it is so cheap that you could not go to the local Motel 6 for this price. And I thought, I'm not going to the local Motel 6 for 2 weeks at Christmas time anyways. This is not relevant to me. But he decides he's going to seek the information of it. Does, and finds out, of course, at the time that there's only two places left, and he has to make up his mind, of course, so fast. So he does. I'm not at the house at the time, but he signs us up, gives us our credit card numbers, and we're ready to go to Russia at Christmas time. And we were going with a Finnish air tour company, which made me feel a little secure. And they sent a huge box of all the things that we might need, which terrified me. I mean, I'm pulling out of this box all kinds of information about hypothermia and how to get an emergency visas, U.S. embassy number to call in case of need. So this is the preparation box, and including traction. Slip in traction boots that we were to wear because of the ice on the streets in Moscow. And I thought, oh, I cannot do this. But it was either the choice, you know, staying home at Christmas, worrying about Rudy the whole time, knowing that he was going to take chances, and no matter what country he was in. And so I thought, well, at least if I go with him, we both go down alone, we get locked up alone, or at least I can try to bail him out when he gets in trouble, because he undoubtedly will. This is almost a given.
So,
but yes, the whole trip itself is a long story.
Well, one of the funny things is, let's talk a little bit about the hotel room, because there's been a lot of talk, and I don't get political. I never get political on this show, but I will tell you, for anybody who has been to Moscow, and this is anybody who has made a trip to Moscow, what is the first thing that you notice when you are in a hotel room in Moscow?
Yeah, one thing I noticed was that there was a lamp in the center of the ceiling, and it hangs pretty low. Is that what other people noticed too?
Oh, yes. Everybody notices. Oh, yes. I mean, you cannot go to Moscow without noticing that somebody is watching you. You are never alone. I mean, in Moscow, I wouldn't pick my nose. You know, when you go to the bathroom, you want to keep a towel over you. You don't.
Oh, yes, because yes, you're on candid camera, girl.
And the whole time you are there, you know. And of course,
exactly.
It's so funny to ever think that anybody will fool around in a hotel room in Moscow, because it is like the last. It is like you might as well just go to Times Square and have a camera put on you, because you know they are watching. These people are really they're strange.
Oh, curious. And, you know, we were there in 1983, and look how long that's been, and yet people come back with the same experience stories.
They've been doing it forever. It's just part of their... They have a whole group of people who just love to watch people in their hotel rooms.
They must have a whole band.
I mean, really.
TV sets, right? Rudy got really good at it, because he took it as a positive. You know, he took it as a concierge service. And he would, you know, go up to the microphone, which was in the lamp, and say things like, it's really cold in here. Do you think, Mary, that there's any more blankets in the closet? And then he'd wait a while, and then he'd say, there's no more blankets in the closet. Cold, cold.
Or
the telephone would ring, and they'd want to know how many blankets we wanted.
or fun to sing songs like the Yellow Rose of Texas, you know, and
exactly.
It gives you such a kick to think, or you know, to dance, and it's so funny. Because, of course, they also have those lovely monitor people in the hallways who are so happy, so happy to hold your key for you.
My key lady was my angel, though.
I know. They're nice. Yeah. They're nice ladies.
She was such a nonverbal friend. You know, she would look at you with just affection. She was...
Well, listen to me. She should be your friend. She's seen you go into the bathroom. So, you know, excuse me.
It's pretty intimate.
There's exactly. She's seen you. She's seen you probably naked more than your mother has. So, you know, you get very familiar with these people.
You accommodate to these things after a while, you know.
Exactly. So, Rudy enjoyed the trip to Moscow. Huh?
Yes, he actually left the tour, which when I think about it, even now, even today, I think, I can't believe this man. But yeah, he found old clothes. I don't know. He usually brings old clothes from thrift stores when he travels in Eastern Europe, and more European-looking shoes that he gets over there, used ones. And he left the tour group, you know, and the tour guide from Interest would try to pretend that she didn't see that he had left. That was her best move. And he went out, you know, seeing Moscow on his own, meeting some people, helping people with their abacus in the stores. he had his great independent tour, even in the midst of that very controlled setting.
Well, I
just tried not to look. That's what I
Yeah, because that could get very suspicious, especially for somebody who could... also speak German. You never know what the Russians would do with you, and you might have then had a nice trip to Siberia. And
could have been. We had all of the clothes for the cold climate. Things would have been okay.
Well, so you were.
That would have been his attitude. That would be his attitude. Was why are we worried? We've got really good thermal boots.
That's it. And well, he had this attitude that somebody nice would come along, right?
Yes, there's always a kind stranger, and Tennessee Williams is one of his favorite authors. So there was a kind stranger that would be around every corner. You just had to get to the right corner is what I was thinking. But somebody that would help us out of our problems and set us on the way. And, you know, I have to admit, most of the time he was right. There was somebody that, you know, saw our stupidity, our naivety, and wanted to help.
And it is true.
Saw me crying in the corner.
and it is so... As I said, I think that kind of travel where you just go and you
yes.
are part of just the whole atmosphere without having everything, you know, organized and without having this mm-hmm. GPS following everything and even this little device that people, you know, they have the phone and they look up the restaurant and they know exactly, well, this is the...
Oh, yes.
I you never know what kind of restaurant you're going to enter, right?
Right, and that's part of it, and it's part of seeing who's in that restaurant, you know. You see people traveling and walking along the sidewalk and their head is down. I'm thinking, well, for one thing, you're going to trip. You know, my mother would have said that. And then the other is, whose eyes are you looking into? Whose eyes have you missed? You know, I think you're right, absolutely.
And I do tell people so often, you know, when you're, I know everybody likes to Facebook, and they think that this is going to be great, you know, that it's that kind of travel where you get someplace, you take a picture, and I've been there, but you haven't actually
yes.
lived the time. You haven't
right.
interacted with the people, and that really is what comes. Those are the memories that are really important. So Facebook pictures are, you know,
absolutely.
Will be there. But the memory, for example, I want to talk about just the girl who you gave a ride home to, or more
oh,
or less,
dear God.
In
oh,
Florence.
My. Oh, my.
I mean, but that's a beautiful
that
story.
It was definitely Rudy at his finest when he came back to the car and introduced me and said the bartender had loaned her to us. And I said, he loaned her to us. He says, well, she's his girlfriend. He loaned her to us. She lives in the neighborhood of the hotel you're going to. We were lost for hours, you know, trying to find our hotel that was a tourist hotel, which we didn't usually go to. And that was one reason we were being punished, we thought, was we couldn't find, there probably was no such thing with sense of deposit. But anyway, so the girl, Maria, Rudy clears a place for her in the back seat of the car. And you read this, where she's going to help us get home, but she's never ridden in a car to her home. She rides the bus. So she has no idea where these streets are. But her contribution, though, to my safety was that as soon as we'd come close to an intersection, she would begin to pray her Ave Marias and bring out her rosary beads and just with this loud, mournful, fearful cry, and it slowed Rudy's driving down. So that was very helpful. And with the driving slowed down, we could see the neighborhoods better, and she finally got us close to but not at the hotel. And then we go to the Calcio with her. And that is a remarkable experience. If anyone's heading to Florence, you got to put the Calcio on your list of pageants to look for.
Oh, it is. It's a very special time of the year, and I love Florence. It's absolutely
Isn't
fantastic.
It beautiful?
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. And you don't want to have your head down in your phone when you're in Florence.
You want to be looking up.
You want to be looking. Wow, it's just
right. And you don't want to be in that tour bus with your nose up against the window.
No,
trying to see what's going on.
You want to get lost in the streets, and that's part of the fun. My husband and I remember very well. We arrived to the outskirts of Rome at 5 o'clock. And we said, boy, we're going to be at our hotel in time to have a nice early dinner. And at 11 o'clock, when we finally found our hotel.
You poor thing. Did you circle and circle?
Oh, we circled. We went here. We stopped here. We finally got a gelato. I had to put petrol in a car. Isn't it fun those days when you had to put petrol in a car?
And the petrol tanks were really small, so you're always putting petrol in the car.
Well, in my case, it was so funny. In our case, we had, I don't know why we did this, we had a white Cadillac. And we were driving. Now, do you know how long it takes to put petrol in a white Cadillac?
Oh, my God.
It was so funny.
No, I was never allowed to be in those.
It was hilarious. And, of course, there were streets that we almost got stuck in. So but that was part of the fun. And, you know, I love the way that Rudy just jumped in there and did it and made your life so interesting. Let's talk about one of the other places. How did you get to Bali? Because everybody's always talking about they want to go to Bali, but not many people actually make it there.
Yes, well, that was one of the times of the marriage test, you know, where you can't decide what kind of vacation you're going to have. One of you wants to finally relax along a beautiful beach, and the other wants to have a cultural experience in the artistic community, and that would be Rudy and me. And so we divided. I read this article in some woman's magazine or newspaper about how your marriage could live longer if you did turn-taking. Instead of trying to compromise all the time, instead it would be turn-taking. So we decided to take, I think it was 4 weeks in Bali, 3 to 4 weeks. And we divided the number of days, and each of us got to plan. And we ended up with two totally different vacation experiences. I, of course, took us to a beach resort, where even the Balinese people were humiliated by the clothes that the tourists wore. And then Rudy took us up into the mountain in Ubud at a time before Ubud was in the tourist literature. It was a small Hans Snell, the Dutch painter, lived up there, and he was about the only cultural center at the time. And, of course, that's grown. I haven't been back, but I understand it's grown exponentially. And so we split the time, and when, of course, I picked, you know, I thought I would have like a taxi that would take us to my resort, and then we went beach walking from there. When it was Rudy's turn, my weeks were up, he had promised me that he would not take me for up to the mountains in the BMO, which the people's, like a little bus, except you're facing each other. It's a very small bus. And you're facing each other knee to knee, and your ducks and your your roosters are between you. So I had told him that with our luggage and all, we could not travel in a BMO, and he had to promise me. And so he looked very sad, but he had, you know, the big blue eyes, and he looks up at me and says, "I promise no BMO this time." Well, I'm standing at the checkout counter in this beautiful resort hotel when Rudy comes with the alternate transportation, and it is no BMO. It is so much worse than a BMO that it's hard to describe. I could hear it coughing, you know, all the way up the driveway. And the staff were coming out because they were worried about our safety. It was the oldest truck you have ever seen, and it made all of these grunting and roaring sounds on flat ground, and we were going to head up into the hills.
Well,
Rudy became the driver's friend, and that was the end of the story. Ride with Hadi.
And that was Rudy, and he was a very, very special person. And Mary, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And to talk about this wonderful book. It's a fascinating book. I think people should read it, one, to learn your story, but also to plan their story. Because if you're going to be traveling, plan your story today. Because yes, in 30 years from now, you are going to want to write it. And make sure that you make a lot of wonderful memories, just like you and Rudy did. So the name of the book is Rudy's Rules for Travel, Life Lessons from Around the Globe. And I think Rudy was really terrific. And I think you're terrific, because this is a delightfully written book. It's just a wonderful read. And I'm just so happy that you were on the program today.
Cassie, I can't thank you enough. It was so enjoyable. And I hope you come visit me sometime in Northern California.
Okay. Well, I will, because I get out there quite often. So, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. And I will have this interview up on my archives in a few days. And also, people can go and order the book. It's just wonderful. Bye-bye now, Mary.
Again, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Wow, she's nice. This is exactly the kind of book I want everyone to write, a nice book about your life, or if you're writing a memoir, write about your family. And I would recommend Maria's Journey by Trish and Ray Arredondo. That's an example of a story if you want to write about your family. And as I say, remember that one of the joys of life is to be to be a writer, to see your words on paper, to hear them spoken in an audible book, or someday maybe even in a film. And you can do it. Everybody can do it. It's just a matter of sitting down and starting to write. And I want to also remind everyone that the Indie Book Publishing Awards are coming up, contest at Reader's Digest. You have until April 2nd to enter your book. So please do that. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. He's saluting me. I'm saluting him. Bye-bye for now.